With Matt and Hillary. What are you laughing at already?
I was just like, why did I say hello that way?
I don't know. I mean, we say hello every time, so it's our catchphrase.
I know it's our catchphrase, Matt.
You have to say it differently sometimes just to like
hello.
You know, keep it fresh.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm Matt.
Oh, I'm Hillary.
And this is our podcast called Marooned on Mars with Matt and Hillary, where we talk about Kim Stanley Robinson novels. And this is the first episode. This is actually episode one. Last time was episode zero of 2312, talking about the novel 2312, which came out in 2012. And that was a good year.
Was it?
It's better than this one. I'll tell you that right now.
I can't remember.
Remains to be seen. It's only July. This year could be starting.
Oh, could get really, really great. Yeah.
Could start getting really good.
I would say signs are definitely pointing in the direction that things are going to get really good from here on out.
For sure.
People are dying in extraordinary heat waves in the Northwest. What else is going on? The Gulf of Mexico is on fire.
Yeah. People are dying all over the place for all kinds of really cool, novel reasons.
Everybody's obsessed with the wet bulb temperature, you know?
I know, that's, yeah. The funny thing is like, you know, I talked to Stan a couple weeks ago and he was looking forward to not having to talk about the Ministry for the Future anymore because he's been talking about it like nonstop since it came out and he's got so many requests for media. And I know like that's never going to stop.
Yeah.
As long as the climate keeps getting hotter, until a new great novel about imminent climate change and what to do about it comes out, you know?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, people are just like, they long for a person to tell them what to do, you know?
Yes. 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 Yeah, I think that one thing we wanted to talk about today, and I think this kind of ties in with something that we're about to talk about, which is Lauren Berlant.
Oh yeah.
And a little bit about her and her legacy, especially regards the sentimental novel.
Them.
Yes.
Oh yeah. That's fine. I mean, it's fine for me, but that's, yeah.
It's, yeah. Right. I didn't really know Lauren that well at all. Like I may have met her once, but now, I mean, she wouldn't know who I was. They wouldn't know who I was. So, but you knew them.
Only a little bit. I mean, only in passing. They were on leave when I was in coursework. So I never, when I did, was doing my PhD.
Okay.
So I never took a class from them, which it was, I think, okay. Probably,
good.
It was both like too bad and also right. Probably saved me from like making yet another insane decision about how I would spend my graduate school years. Because like there's no way I could have taken a class from them without being like, oh, this is what I want to do. And
right.
You know.
I mean, I had read something, you know, by them when I was working in math.
Yeah.
But the Cruel Optimism chapter and had not really read anything else by them, but so many of my friends in grad school were either advised by them or heavily influenced by them. So many of my advisees in math had come, you know, or maybe not my advisees, but several people's advisees had come to Chicago to work with them.
Yeah.
And they had a very outsized presence at the University of Chicago for like, I didn't really realize that Lauren came there when she was 27 years old as an assistant professor, which is
crazy,
you know, probably never going to happen again to anybody. Yeah, I thought we would just start a little bit by talking a little bit about them and their thought and how, you know, it's interesting to think, to put just theory and ideas that may not fit next to, you know, a variety of novels or modes or whatever, and see what sort of comes up. And it's not like they wrote about science fiction all that much, from what I understand. But I think Stan's novels, you know, it's interesting to, even though, you know, I think they're having two different conversations, but I think that those two different conversations kind of, you know, put together can be interesting to think about.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one thing I think about Lauren's work, and I don't know whether this is a way that everybody would describe their work, but, you know, so, I mean, so they're like famous as a theorist and famous for, really for being able to, I think, produce formulations about what it means to sort of try to carve out a life, a sustainable way of living in a world that increasingly seems unsustainable, and how much the work of trying to make your life feel like it's livable or okay, is about trying to maintain proximity to certain kinds of normativity. So rather than what, you know, we often think that like queer theory or feminist theory in particular do, like, which is to be critical of norms, like, I think one thing you might think about Lauren's work is it's always asking, not in a like celebratory way, but it's always asking about like what it is that norms give us and why it is that we can continue, even when like sort of knowing better or not wanting it, or just like when the material conditions are so obviously not there to support whatever this normative picture of the good life is, why we continue to have some kind of, as they would say, attachment to mm-hmm. those norms. And in many ways, I think of their work, I mean, and I think this is explicit in a lot of their work. I mean, one, their work is very much kind of about like, you know, I think thinking through a lot of questions about capitalism, and particularly about late capital, and for their like later work, from the Reagan era, basically onward, thinking about capital, you know, informed by extraordinary, I mean, this is like a person who just like, I think read everything and knew about everything and was very frightening to speak to because of the extraordinary amount of knowledge that they had. But, you know, thinking about capital in a way absolutely informed by Marx and by Marxist thought, but also through sort of feminism and queer theory, and in this kind of like mixture, producing something that is very like distinctive and interesting way to think. But to me, anyway, it's like a kind of, in some ways, their work is a kind of iteration or an opening up of stuff that we talk about in Raymond Williams all the time. So if we can, we frequently I guess we do that in the rest of our lives too, but also on this podcast, we've talked a lot about Raymond Williams's idea of the dominant, the residual, and the emergent. And that sort of historical structure is the kind of thing that like Lauren's work could be said to kind of make apparent within the current conjuncture, within the current time in which we're living, in the contemporary. And also, and really particularly, I think that Lauren was, you know, you can see a lot of their work as taking up our favorite concept, the structure of feeling. Unlike Williams, thinking about what feeling is through like, you know, feminism and through psychoanalytic theory to some extent, through affect theory, but really like, asking about what the sort of like the place is of feeling in the ways in which we do or don't manage to kind of live in the world. So, I mean, and I think just like an easy example of this, and probably something that like Lauren had not said for years, but in the at the beginning of the war in Afghanistan, which is supposedly ending now, so many years later, Lauren was part of a group in Chicago called Feel Tank, which is like a joke off of Think Tank, right? And one of their slogans, and like, you know, you would see like Feel Tank people out. I mean, I was like at a lot of, you know, demonstrations in that period, and you would see Lauren and other people from that group there. And one of their slogans was depressed, it might be political, which is this kind of like, you know, Gramscian structure of feeling, Raymond Williamsian structure of feeling, kind of like play, and then also playful and sort of like provocative, but also like, you know, asking a really serious question about like the sort of waning attachment to the idea that the political might be the place in which one could produce something like change at all. Which, you know, has only increased. I mean, you know, I think that you and I have talked a lot about not thinking that like the political is the place where you can produce change anymore. But we could think about something like the Bernie campaign as really like kind of playing out. Depressed, it might be political. Let's try to solve your, let's try to solve that depression by attaching to like this, you know, charming old man who's going to like save us all or whatever, whatever it is, you know what I mean? So I'm just like kind of riffing here, but just like an incredibly generative thinker who I think is very much, whose work can sit in a lot of the kinds of critical traditions that I think both of us find really useful for thinking about, you know, why you should care about texts of all kinds, for one thing.
Yeah. Well, so like on the point about norms and attachment, and I was reading, so a lot of people were pointing out on Twitter in at their at Lauren's passing, like the influence they had on them, and that they were saying, you know, poor Eliza, which is a chapter from her book, The Female from their book, The Female Complaint. Sorry for mispronouncing Lauren, but I, you know, went anyway. That poor Eliza made them like Americanists. So I was like, oh, I've never read poor Eliza. And I used to want to be an Americanist. so I should read this.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's about, it's a lot about Uncle Tom's Cabin. And I mean, the book is about the sentimental novel. And that chapter has a lot to do with Uncle Tom's Cabin and various iterations of Uncle Tom's Cabin throughout other novels and plays and media and stuff like that. And the point that Lauren makes about the sentimental is that it's, especially in regards to Uncle Tom's Cabin, is that it's a mode in which the reader, you know, a range of feeling and affect and sense of being in the world are marshaled in order for the reader to feel a sense of empathy that will then sort of propel them into the political and make them aware, make the reader aware of this kind of suffering that is, you know, make the reader share in the suffering of others that will then get the reader to like act politically and awaken. And like, that's how change can happen. But also what that kind of aestheticization of politics and feeling do is allow for the exact opposite to happen, like for nothing to happen, actually. And so much of the desire for norms and the desire for attachment is also a desire for the attachment of things to sort of stay the same, or like a kind of sentiment for, you know, whatever would be normal, which would, you know, sort of seem to militate against any kind of actual change.
Yeah.
Which I think is interesting to think about in relation to Ministry for the Future, for that exact, for the exact reason that we were just talking about, which is that people are desperate for, and Stan has recognized this as well, people are like desperate for a book to tell them what to do or how it's all going to work out, or like what we can do, a book or a leader or a television show or whatever. Like, what do we do? Tell us what to do. They want to be told what to do. Mm-hmm. And that's a mode that is very deeply, seems to be both very deeply American and very deeply like problematic because as an aesthetic mode, it does allow for this kind of, you know, and one of the key parts of Berlant's kind of thought on this is that there is an ambivalence there, and that ambivalence is something that we want to really think through. It's not something that's, you know, positive or negative in any way. It is sort of constitutive or structural about the moment that we live in and the kind of culture that we live in as well. So it's problematic. It's not good or bad. It's not one thing or another. It sort of just is. And but one thing that, and I'll sort of conclude with this, because in that chapter, Berlant sort of posits a mode called the counter-sentimental, they write, more than a critique of human empathic attachment as such, the counter-sentimental modality challenges the place literature and storytelling have come to stand for in the normalization of gestures of emotional humanism in the United States. And that seems to be something that also is not maybe directly, you know, dealt with or addressed in a KSR novel, but is something that I think you could read into the novel a little bit, or some of his novels a little bit, in terms of what is the role, especially this one, who knows, especially like what is the role of art in producing change or sort of advancing history or something like that, right?
Yeah, that just was making me think about, you know, in another essay of Berlant's, the essay called Slow Death, which is in a book called Cruel Optimism. And I don't know if anyone who's listening is interested in reading anything by Berlant. I mean, I would recommend that essay called Slow Death, which I think is really incredible and is kind of, at least I think it in some ways is a sort of, it can be seen as in some ways as a kind of extension of the chapter on the working day in Capital Volume 1. But also the book called The Queen of America Goes to Washington City, which Berlant wrote supposedly for like a sort of wider audience. Although honestly, it also is pretty hard to read. I mean, that's the thing about Berlant, like I think you can get it if you just are like, I'm just going to read this and kind of go with it, because they're very good at like producing a phrase that is not just a phrase, but is actually like changing how you think about things. And so, you know, if you can read a novel, you can also read Berlant. It's just like, there are going to be a lot of references to things. There's like nobody who, I mean, yeah, their kind of breadth of reference and their seriousness of engagement with theoretical text makes them tough. But I think that they're pretty readable. But anyway, Queen of America Goes to Washington City, I think, is like a really interesting book, which is a lot about thinking about like hegemony and the political and also national sentimentality. Cruel Optimism is, I think, a really, really amazing book and extremely important, just like a very important book. I mean, we've talked about the idea of cruel optimism before, right? This sort of like, which is in at least in part like, you know, optimism as the attachment to a story about the good life or what's good for you, where like that attachment has frayed, or it is like increasingly palpably apparent in the day-to-day that like there's nothing sustaining in this attachment, you know, and you can see this all over the place, like in the ways in which people like sort of articulate their sense that their student debt or not being able to ever buy a house, like sort of are preventing them from living out a certain kind of life. In that there is also an attachment to that as the picture of what is good, right? Rather than the sort of rejection of that, the attachment is still there. The attachment is powerful, right? Anyway, but I was thinking as you're talking, there's this really great point in the essay called Slow Death, which is a kind of point that they make in many different ways. But, you know, when we, and I think is like, is sort of a Foucauldian point, or is a point that they take and kind of they work with Foucault in order to make this point, but that, like, you know, what we think of action being is basically heroic action. So when we imagine right. something like how does change happen or what is a revolution, and you know, I felt like saying these things, this is extremely pertinent to 2312, which really is, I think, a lot, just like as I'm kind of reading it and rereading it, I think it has some, a lot of like really kind of subtle things about what action is, and the relationship between action and agency. And I am not, you know, whatever, I recognize that these are like topics that philosophers talk about, and I don't know how to go in that direction with them. But I do think that, like, the point that Berlant makes, that we think, when we think agency, when we think about what effectivity is or what can produce change, we're always thinking of it in what they referred to as a melodramatic mode. Mm-hmm. In other words, like a hero, and something extraordinary happens, an event happens following on somebody's action, right? And that action is either heroic or like failed, right? But either way, it's a melodrama, right? The key is very, very high, you know? And that, I think, that kind of thought, I think, is very instructive, whether you like think that, you know, we have a chance at like radical social transformation and like, you know, continuing to have Earth be a livable world for human type creatures, whether you think that that chance comes to the political or whether you think it comes elsewhere, like thinking about like what the ideas that we have and what kinds of versions of agency we sort of like hold onto, those are like really important questions to kind of wrestle with. And they are questions about like individuality, right? Versus like action or agency that is diffused or spread out. But they're also a question about what we think it is to be agential at all, right? And that kind of melodramatic mode of thinking that, like, you know, what is agency in the world is sort of like heroic effectivity, like that's very closely attached to that sentimental mode, right? You know, because the sentimental mode is like the sweet side of it or something like that, right? But anyway, I think that sort of thinking and that sort of like their work is very much characterized by like kind of really forcing the person who's reading them or listening to them talk to think very hard about not just what seems obvious and therefore you don't see it, but like why it seems obvious. And in those moves, I think always there is the possibility of opening up another dimension, which is what else is there, right? And that, I think, you know, which is like a little bit less the kind of thing that like Lauren wrote about, but I think it's always a presence there, you know, like if these kinds of attachments are sort of like inevitable, like what else might they give us, right? Other than the world of like injustice, impoverishment, you know, in which like one person's pleasures is always going to be another person's pain, right? Yeah,
there's two things, two other quotes that sort of maybe relate to that about the counter-sentimental that I wrote down. And I don't think that Robinson's novels are either sentimental or counter-sentimental. I think that there's an interesting, and it's only one rubric that Berlant talked about, and it's only the essay that I happen to read. And so this is all that just like my brain firing off, like as if we were in a seminar right now. So this is not prescriptive at all, but like, I think what's interesting about the novels in relation to reading Berlant and this essay specifically on the sentimental is the way that these novels seem to, you know, negotiate or wrestle with these terms in an ambivalent way, right? So I think there are sentimental aspects to them, and I think there are counter-sentimental aspects to them, and that's what makes them sort of interesting in this context. But one thing Berlant writes is the unfinished business of the counter-sentimental. The counter-sentimental refuses to confuse survival with freedom, justice, or the good life. So merely surviving is something that we spend a lot of time and energy doing. And part of that survival means that we have to attach ourselves to things that are actively hurting us. That's the cruel optimism argument. But to resist the sentimental is to understand as well that survival is not freedom, justice, or the good life, that it's that it is mere survival, right? And then another thing that they write is a history of overcoming our learned resistance to non-repetition, and this ties into 2312, a history of overcoming our learned resistance to non-repetition will, at least for a moment, revitalize the experience of the intimate, the social, memory, and the nation. And that's interesting in that, so this learned resistance to non-repetition is such a difficult phrase to parse, but I kind of think about it as another way to phrase it, or the kind of an obverse way to phrase it would be an appetite for the new, right? An appetite for the novel, not the novel, the book, but the new, which, you know, capitalism and modernity, you know, inculcate in us constantly. Like you don't want to ever do the same thing again. You want to have constantly new experiences all the time. And you know, that's one of the sort of promises of modernity, is like you can be a different person every day of the week. And of course, that's cool, but it's also incredibly exhausting. And what you get if you, what one gets if one lives a different life every single day of the week, is a profound sense of loss of things that have, that do sustain human beings, which is repetition, right? Which is habit and ritual and tradition. So that there's that sense that is, again, a Williamsian sense that, like, just because something is traditional doesn't mean that it's bad. Just because something is residual doesn't mean that it's bad. Just because something's that is dominant or emergent doesn't mean that it's good. Right. But there's ambivalence everywhere that we look. And the trick would be to sort of figure out what are the elements of these aspects that would that are worth saving and cultivating in order to eventually achieve sort of freedom, justice, and the good life. And the intimate, the social, memory, and even she writes the nation, they write the nation here as an aspect of non-repetition, are sort of available to building a counter-sentimental relation to relation that could be, you know, productive in a good way.
I mean, I think that that's actually really, I mean, just like as a set of terms, I think that's really perfect for thinking about 2312. You know, we talked last time about whether or not it's right to call this like a sort of novel of the post-human. And again, I think that that's really not right. I think that this is a novel about, one, humans, and two, the earth, which is, I think, something we'll probably like get back to talking about it later. But I think one thing to think about, just like that is very much related to the novel and that kind of plays off what you were just saying, is like, yeah, so what's the difference between that kind of like that ceaseless like appetite for novelty under Capital, right? What's the difference between that and sort of like also and being able to like do something, and this is speculative, like we're very far from being able to do this, but do something like kind of cast off the chains of like sexed and gendered self-identification, right? So like, you know, one sort of like vision that, you know, and I, that people sometimes, you know, articulate via sci-fi is like, okay, you know, if gendering is fundamentally, or at least in part, maybe not fundamentally, but at least part of what gender is like it's a demand for continuity, right? I mean, this is why it's hard when you learn that someone's pronouns have changed, right? Yes. Because like, although, you know, you or perhaps no one other than that person may have any idea of like what that change means or whether or not is in fact a change, but simply a revelation of something that's always been there. And I think people, you know, think quite differently about that. But part of what's hard about that and part of why, you know, people are so resistant to the idea that one could change one's pronouns and in fact that one might insist on being referred to in a way that you know you're just not familiar with, right? Or like everybody, you know, as a certain kind of person always says about they, it's not even a singular, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. So but part of that is because like you've done something that violates this, what is taken to be this very basic part of how we recognize each other, which is that something I demand from you, from my friends, from my intimates, but not just from them, from my colleagues, my acquaintances, and maybe even like, you know, the people who are not my acquaintances, is that they be continuous. And I know that it's you that I'm talking to, right? Mm-hmm. And that, right, there is something in there that like, I think, you know, my feeling is that most people like know in their bones that that is a kind of trap, right? Mm-hmm. That like, we are different all the time, you know, we are, and that doesn't mean we're, you know, an entirely different person from day to day. But that like that capture by gender as it's, you know, like named in a pronoun, like, that is a capture. It's a capture mm-hmm. of something that is much harder to say or to understand, or you can't even maybe tell a story about at all. Mm-hmm. But the question is like, how do you both, so you can imagine like some future in which people get to be whatever gender they want to be. And there's just this real proliferation of identities, right? It, you know, but that can really sort of coincide with like a kind of novelty, an ethos of novelty, right? And also with a kind of libertarianism, you know, like, you know, this is simply about the individual, right? And it is a matter of like, you know, individual play and preference. And I think a lot of like post-human future SF kind of lands there. And partly some of it lands there because it's written by people who are actually very serious and care about these questions, right? But a lot of it lands there because it's written by people who don't really care about these questions about sex or gender or sexuality. They care about like a libertarian account of what freedom is, right? Mm-hmm. And with this novel, like, I think we're in a much better position to think about like, yeah, so what does it look like when, not being bound, not being bound by that kind of gendered demand, is not a matter of something like novelty, right? Or an individuated account of what liberty or freedom is. But instead is something else, right? Let's us imagine something quite different. I think that that is one thing that this novel is kind of trying to do, right? But at the same time, I do think, and you know, this I think is something that I'm just like really beginning to think this about this novel. I do think it has like a real critique in it, maybe not a critique, but like it has a real concern with the way in which certain forms of frictionless apparent liberation can be all too comfortable with a kind of like libertarian novelty, you know, and can be about like an ignorance of the places where, like, let's say, capture, dispossession, and like outright enslavement are still going on and are in fact perhaps underpinning the whole thing. And at the same time, I think the thing that this book does that is like, you know, just awesome is that it also like, you know, like you were saying about that kind of like the ambivalence, it also like shows us like a lot of things that are free and freeing and intensely gorgeous and mind expanding and activate that like thought of like just like radical difference, what a radically different experience of being human. We get to see so much of that here. And I think that that like And I'll stop talking, but I do think that that is a little bit bound up in this novel with some ideas about sentiment too. Like in a kind of, you know, in that I think we see Swan on something of a sentimental journey. In other words, a journey in which she's like, at least in part, getting the kind of like the education of the heart, you know, this very like 18th century idea, which was really about making like good, you know, like what's a good capitalist subject, right? Well, their heart also has to be educated too. Right. And a little bit, you know, we see her kind of like picaresque leaping from world to world to world. So that version of sentiment is up there, you know, against and in a kind of critical tension with these questions about both freedom and also like repetition, and then the idea of the iterative and the pseudo iterative as like sustaining ways of living. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sorry, that was long.
Sustaining ways of living and sustaining one's like sort of sense of self, just like realizing, remembering who you are, or you know, what overall trajectory you might be on. But yeah, like that sense of novelty and freedom of identity, and to identify in a kind of negative formulation, like the libertarian sort of way. I wonder how much Swan, at least in the, you know, first half of the book, comports with that. Like she's a completely free spirit, but is also free in the sense of like just doing stuff just for the sake of doing them without any regard for, you know, why she's necessarily like why she's doing them, if there's a larger project there, if it's just pure self-gratification, risk, you know, addiction to risk type of thing. That kind of, and also just complete disregard for, sort of a lot of the consequences of her actions.
Yeah.
She's a really difficult character to like, or to imagine wanting to spend time with, at least, you know, initially. we should just sort of get into the novel and start thinking about that, because we do find her at the very beginning in this moment of distress where her grandmother has died. And she is, her grandmother, Alex, who was this, you know, seminal germinal figure, excuse me. Yeah. in mercurial society, and in the kind of, overall solar system, political economy, I guess, although it's hard to know what exactly she does or what her project is or what her field is. But Swan is, you know, attending this funeral, which was going to be a conference that Alex had been organizing, and now is this like funeral. And so we meet her at a moment where we want to sympathize with her, but there's not very many ways in sort of to her to sympathize, to participate in her sentiment, right? Not to like keep pushing the sentimental thing, but
yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting in these first chapters because we, you know, for the reader, like we don't really know. We're trying to figure out what is she like. And we know some things about like things she does. I mean, we know from the beginning that she likes to like test herself physically and sort of spiritually. We know that she, you know, makes certain kind of artworks, performs certain kinds of artworks. I think she's very strongly associated with performance. We only learn a little. So we were, God knows how long we're going to talk today, but we were sort of imagining we might get up to the chapter called Io. At this point, I'm like, no way are we getting through 65 pages of this.
We talk too much.
You know, we learn in this first section of the novel that she's not, I was just supposed to say, just an artist, but she also was a major designer of asteroid ecologies, right? Of all of these like different like environments that were built and are still being built inside these hollowed out asteroids, which is just like, I mean, that, you know, this is not like, you know, not a conceit made up by KSR, the hollowed out asteroid world, but it's so just beautiful here. It just like the tour of little worlds is, it's just fantastic. But, you know, so it's hard to put Swan together, right? Because, and also, as you were saying to me before we started recording, like, she's 130.
Whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. She's, you know, she's no spring chicken. And at the same time, there's something about her that feels very much like she is 21 years old.
So we were talking about how in, you know, the, like this life extension thing that KSR works with so often is like in the Mars trilogy, when life extension came to the characters of the Mars books, those characters were already like in their 50s. So, you know, they had already like matured to a certain level, but then the question, it becomes like, well, what happens when life extension, like functional immortality, or you're going to live for 200, is the norm from the moment that you're born. Right.
Yeah.
And then, so does that mean just adolescence is just like your entire life? Like you never have to grow up. And like, that's the boomer generation. Is it not? I mean, these people do not believe they're going to die in a really serious way. And you know, with catastrophic results, obviously. I mean, so anyway, that was what I thought of when we were,
about that. Yeah. That extended adolescence, or like, when do you go through the sort of like the kind of life events? I mean, which I think for a lot of us, like the life events that like teach you these things about how you're going to manage yourself as like a grown up. Those life events are just like really like the shitty stuff of like, you know, oh, now I have a full-time job.
Or, yeah.
It is.
Well, yeah. It's, you know, and it's hard to remember, but it's important to remember that all of that shit was invented in the last 100 years of like having a full-time job that you're going to go to 9 to 5, almost 365 days a year, you know, 300 days out of the year, whatever, that all of that stuff was an invention of the 20th century and is totally alien to like human being.
Oh yeah. As was adolescence, right?
As was
post-World War II, basically.
The pressure. Yeah. I think adolescence was invented in the 20s. Teenagerdom was really much more of an invention of the 50s, I want to say.
Yeah.
But I think adolescence was an invention of the 20s, where suddenly this privileged class of people who were going to college, who were like, first of all, had like mandatory publicly funded high school education. And then there's an even more rarefied class of those people who were going to go to college and have their, you know, get a little bit more seasoning before they entered the world of empire management, essentially. So that you had this like delay, right? And but also that the anxiety about when am I going to have kids, and when are we going to buy a house, and all of this kind of stuff begins to enter into people's decision making, and like idea of who they're going to be and what trajectory their life is going to have, and all of this kind of stuff that produces like an incredible amount of like social anxiety, essentially, because you're measuring yourself against other people. I mean, I think with the boomer generation, like the kind of, especially in America, the incredible affluence, the rapid increase in like, college education, living the quote unquote good life, the construction of that good life, and then the promotion of that good life around the world. Just in time for when the boomer generation started to enter into middle and old age, the invention of all kinds of great new drugs that kept people happy and peppy and kept their boners working and let them keep golfing all the time. I mean, like, why would you ever believe that the party could ever end if you had all of this pharmacopoeia keeping you you know, with your pension and with your, I mean, obviously this is a caricature of that generation. It's the problem with generational thinking in general, but these are the ruling class. These are the ruling ideas that we're all kind of grappling with, hollowing out of, as we watch the news every day.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I mean, and I think as we go on in this novel too, we'll get to, actually some really interesting stuff about like the sort of, like particularly hormonal kinds of enhancements that people that go along with the longevity treatments, an interesting kind of, addition to the thinking about longevity, from the Mars books here, we get like a lot more detail about kind of like, what are the kinds of things that need to be supplemented in order to make this, in order to make this work out? But, you know, certainly at this moment, you know, we're kind of like, we meet Swan at the moment of the death of a parent, which, you know, at least, I mean, you know, and more than a parent, right? Alex is like grandparent, but also mother, but also mentor, but also everything. Swan says she was everything. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's interesting how little we really know about Alex, and we don't even know very much. She was the Lion of Mercury, and we don't even know very much about what that position is. I mean, it seems to be a kind of sort of political, sort of spiritual leadership position. But we only get that in kind of bits and pieces, right? So there are aspects of like the kind of life ways within the solar system that we really just have to kind of like pick up on and make some kinds of, draw some kinds of conclusions for ourselves. So we see Swan like probably in some kind of like, what's the word? Like a cusp moment or something, right? And this is kind of enhanced because like, oh, it's also a mystery. Maybe there's a mystery around how Alex died. Doesn't totally seem like there is, but maybe there's a mystery about like what Alex left behind. Maybe there's a mystery about the project that Alex was working on, you know, like, so we have the sense that like, there is something to be kind of found out here, and that the, like, at least part of the detection will fall on Swan. Although our thinking that that's how this is going to go gets really derailed very quickly because we meet two kind of incredible figures. One, Inspector Jean Genette or Jean Genette, right. and two, Fitzwarren, or Warram, the toad, Swan's toad, and then suddenly, you know, we're in just like, well, okay, this doesn't look like Swan could possibly be the detective here, since one person is an inspector, and the other person also seems to be there in the role of detective. So we have this kind of, you know, the positioning in terms of like what we might expect is going to happen is like funny and kind of like skewed, and we have these kinds of like, all right, how are these people and why are these people sort of circling around each other? But just before we get to a little further in, I just want to, I love the, I mean, the description of the city Terminator is just incredible throughout. Mm-hmm. And when at the, I'm on page 8 in my edition, which is just like one page into Swan and Alex. So we're really moving quickly here. And Swan is basically like, she's back at Terminator and she can't deal with being at the public part of the funeral. And this, I think, is all very sympathetic, you know, like, people see her and recognize her and say nice things about Alex, but she just is, she's like lost and sad and doesn't even want to like talk to Alex's partner. She doesn't feel like she has anything to give anyone. But this, I just like this image of the scattering of Alex's ashes. She was not quite to the farm when the great gates of the Dawn Wall opened and sunlight cut through the air under the dome, creating the usual horizontal pair of yellow translucent bars. She focused on the swirls within the bars, the talcum they tossed up there when they opened the gates, colored fines floating on updrafts and dispersing. Then a balloon rose from the high terraces under the wall, drifting west, the little basket swaying under it, Alex, how could it be? A surge of defiance in the music rumbled up out of the basses. When the balloon entered one of the yellow bars of light, the basket blew apart in a poof, and Alex's ashes floated down and out of the light into the air of the city, growing invisible as they descended like a shower of Virga in the desert. There was a roar from the park, the sound of applause. It just like the, it seems like Mercury and Terminator are really associated with this kind of like ceremonial relationship to the sun and the idea of the dawn wall and the opening of the gates that lets the bars of light in. It's just such an incredible image, right? And then Alex's ashes coming down and becoming part of the biome, right? It's just, yeah, it's such a striking like in ritual moment that kind of sets us off here.
Yeah, and it goes with the kind of sense that throughout the, especially the first part of the novel that is emphasized over and over again, that sort of art making and life and technology are all kind of one and the same thing. At least on Mercury, you know, which is now the home to all the great works of art of Earth because they can keep it safer there.
So they say. A little like the British Museum and the Elgin Marbles, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. But that also that like, yeah, even the very, you know, they essentially live in a snow globe in a certain way. So it is this kind of meant to be kind of perfect world that can, you know, emphasize aesthetics in every kind of aspect of life. But that in doing so, like there's a sense that causality and intentionality and agency extends to non-human thing, like not even non-human things, but inanimate things as well. So that like her one of her art practices of making like Goldsworthies and like these rock formations it's on my page 10. Like there's a rock wave that Alex had built or Swan had built. And it says the rocks that had formed the crest of the wave were gone. However, knocked down by the vibration of the passing city, perhaps, or simply by the impact of sunlight or fallen at the news of Alex's death. So that there's this sense of like almost a return to the kind of shamanistic belief in a kind of anime or like geist that pervades everything. Maybe kind of an allusion to Shintoism as well, that there's a life within all of these things, even to the extent that like right after that, she's visiting Makaret.
That's what I'm saying in my head.
Makaret. I think in my head, I often say Margaret, but Margaret. You know, obviously that's wrong, but like I'm a stupid person. So, the lab was filled with machines, tanks, flasks, screens bursting with gnarled colorful diagrams, life in all its sprawling complexity constructed base pair by base pair. So it's not just that, I mean, he's like a DNA engineer or something, like he's literally making life in this lab, but also the lab itself seems to be alive, like the diagrams are alive, the tanks, the flasks, yeah. There's a kind of like circulation and life. In here, they had started life from scratch. So like biology, technology, all of these things are a certain of an art practice, of a making. And they're all kind of endowed, but then at the same endowed with a kind of magic and like I said before, animism, I guess. But even with all of that, Makaret seems a little bit bored. Like he's like, it passes the time. You know, it's something to do while I live forever, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we get back to, I mean, some of that is also because he's just like mourning. So.
Right.
Like,
yes, for sure.
Things feel meaningless. Right. And we get back to we have a bunch of like really great, and different. I keep thinking reading this about that that passage in New York 2140 where the which has gotten I think like quoted a lot, the life will find a way section, which is like just such a beautiful section. But we get a lot of some scenes here, and then some like references to like the making of life, like how do you build, in this section of the novel, there's a great extracts one chapter, which is all about like how to like seed a terrarium, a hollowed-out asteroid. We have like later variants of that too, recipes for how you cook up life, you know, which is a really interesting like, which, you know, take these kind of like, you know, these problems and sort of like domesticate them, make them a matter of like cooking, right? Cooking, stirring things together, finding the ingredients. Even when Swan, much later, when Swan goes to Earth to get the inoculants and other things that they need to for Terminator, that's also about like, basically like it's like a grocery shopping, a large scale grocery shopping trip. yeah, quite like that. Quite like that.
So this in in this first chapter we meet Warum and Jeanette, and one of them is a very tall frog man, and another one is a small Jeanette is a small, and he's about Jeanette, no pronouns for Jeanette, excuse me. Is a meter tall. And I imagine him, I don't know if I was imagining him as like a little person, like one of our earthling little people, or, but now I think I'm just imagining him as a fully proportioned, regular sized human being who is just a meter tall.
Yeah.
And I said him again. So excuse me, you know, I have a attachment to pronouns that is, bad for producing a new utopia. I'm an anti-utopian relationship to pronouns.
I mean, we see, so before we meet Jeanette, we see three smalls standing at the public funeral. So we already know that this is like a sort of like human type now. When we meet Jeanette, the door opened and in the entry stood a small. So clearly there's nothing stigmatizing in being referred to that way. You know, it must be like a self-designation. Very attractive in the way smalls often were. Aged, slender, with a neat blonde ponytail and a casual blue jacket, about waist high to Swan or McCarrot, and looking up at them like a Langer or Marmoset. it's just like it's an amazing image, and it's very, I think, like it's like very it's such a funny because of course like human beings have tons of variations in height, you know, and we don't that I can remember get any sort of story about the origin of the smalls or, you know, whether this is like a way to like extend life or be comfortable in more different kinds of environments or just simply like a, like preference. But we have many like, just like fantastic visions of like later on Jeanette has like a pillow or something, that the inspector like uses in order to like be comfortable on it, sitting on a tabletop, so that the inspector and Swan will be eye to eye when they're talking. Just like this very marvelous like sense of like with Swan, we just meet her as Swan, and that's her name, right? And then with Jeanette, we're like, well, is this a fairy tale? I mean, there is a sort of fairy tale sense. And then that the next person you meet is something like the opposite of Inspector Jeanette, a very big man. I'm not going to be able to say those words that come next in line. Toad, newt, frog, even the very words were ugly. Briefly, it occurred to Swan that onomatopoeia might be more common than people recognized, and their languages echoing the world like birdsong. Swan had a bit of a lark in her brain. Toad. Once she had seen a toad in an Amazonia sitting at the edge of a pond, its warty, wet skin all bronze and gold, she'd liked the look of it. So, like, we're told, at first you're like, oh, this is a man who looks like a toad. But by the end of that paragraph, Swan is just like, yes, you know, toads. I've seen toads. I like the look of a toad. And at this point, it's like, again, that sort of fairy tale sense of like, is one, could this person be part toad? Is that what we're seeing? You know, like, is it Mr. Toad who's come to call? Like, is it just a man who looks like a toad? The confusion is just like really marvelous to me. And again, is this very like, I think is a very charming kind of like destabilizing of what you think is going on. So now we have Swan, who then increasingly you might think Swan-like, right? We have Swan, a small, and a toad is just mm-hmm. like a hilarious like trio of people to begin to be setting out on some kind of adventure with.
Yeah, Jeanette is kind of like the Cheshire Cat or something, like just sort of hanging out on the table. And then also Swan had a bit of lark in her brain, and we don't know yet what that means, if that's just a metaphor, but later we find out that like there's genetic kind of insertions into her that allow her to, like, for example, whistle really well. That is very cool that we're in a kind of Alice in Wonderland sort of world. Warham asks Swan to go out with her to Tintoretto Crater, where all the Tintorettos are, which seems like, I mean, you know, there's all kinds of different ways to archive and categorize things. I guess you can just do it by artist name.
Yeah.
Seems kind of lame to me, kind of like simple, kind of basic, but hey, that's what they're doing.
Well, and amazingly, they're not all Tintorettos either. Some of them are originals, right, and others are indistinguishable copies. So there's like the kind of like, we both have the like, I mean, I do think this is one of the first places where we think like, okay, so what is the relationship of the other planets to Earth? Mm-hmm. Well, Earth has just been deemed like not worthy of keeping the things that were made on Earth. That's one thing that seems to happen here. And we both artwork, but also like animals, as we learn as we go on, right? Right. But then also there's a very funny like, you know, heading out to see like the originals of these famous paintings, which Warham stares at incredibly closely. And Swan just like moves around and like, you know, identifies with some and doesn't identify with others. But some of them are originals and some of them are not originals. They're just like chemically indistinguishable copies, which in itself like makes this just like such a kind of, it's a completely weird space to imagine, like how it maps on to what we think a museum or a space of preservation is, what that's supposed to be.
Also, they're like the only two, they seem to be the only two people there. And then the fact that Warham gets so close to the paintings, it's like, you try doing that at a museum and then you will be told to move away. I did it once, you know, moved up really close. I'm not going to touch the painting, obviously, but there are people who do fucking touch the paintings. And it's like, I've seen it before. And you're like, are you like, not even get your children under control? Like, you're an adult person. Like, you're clearly not allowed to touch that Jackson Pollock. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
So there's a whole different relationship to these paintings that's sort of posited, or like we get a brief sort of glimpse of in these museums. But of course, Swan as on my page 24, and I have the 2018 edition of the novel, they're in the museum, they're in the museum looking at these Tintorettos, and he's completely absorbed, and Swan has a totally different relationship to paintings. He's not sure if he likes it or not. He didn't want to talk about it. Swan went off to look at more Venetians. For her, art was something to make first and foremost, and after that, something to talk about. Ineffable aesthetic responses, communing with a work, these struck her as too precious. One of the portraits glowered, another tried to suppress a little ironic smile. They agreed with her. So now who's communing with the artwork? She was out here with a stick of a toad. Marquette had said Alex revered this man, but now she doubted it could be true. Who was he? What was he? but these various relationships to art, because Alex or Swan is a maker very much so, and doesn't, and, you know, so even her relationship to artworks makes her hard to sort of identify with or sympathize with, because she, even as an artist, she's like, I don't care about all this art.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah. Well, and she, I mean, and also just like, you know, she thinks that Warham should be interested in this very strange space that they're in, right? They're in a crater called Tintoretto Crater, right, where the paintings are, and he doesn't seem to be interested in it. You know, she's very judgy. That is a big part of Swan. Not at all restrained.
Also, like, Warham is sort of having a great time. He's excited to be here, and she's just kind of like bored. Like, oh, when can we leave? I'm bored. Let's go.
Yeah. I was going to say also, we should just point out that right before this chapter, we have a chapter called Lists One, which is just a list of a lot of the names of craters on Mercury, which I had to actually like look up, because I was like, are these really the names of the craters on Mercury? And yes, they are really the names of the craters on Mercury, which is like hilarious. I mean, and we talked, when we were talking about the Mars books, we talked a lot about like naming and what does it mean to like name a feature? What does it mean to name it after? I mean, here, like naming them after like, you know, great Earth, mostly artists of various kinds. What a hilarious and like strange choice when you think about it. And in a bit we get to a chapter called Extracts One. I think we said on the Zero episode, like, most of the chapters in this novel are pretty short. Some are longer, some have more extended narrative, but most of the narrative chapters are pretty short. Most of them are named after either like what characters are featured in the chapter or what character and where they are. So you get this like funny little summary right at the beginning of the chapter. And even those chapter titles seem to de-emphasize narrative in favor of kind of like a scene, right? Of an interaction or something like that. But then we also have these chapters that are lists and these chapters that are extracts, obviously, from longer works, which both become places where we get certain kinds of information, but in like very playful and fragmentary ways. But also, I think, have this really nice, I just think this book has an extremely nice rhythm. And those little breaks like function to feel like they're pulling you more and more into this world of the solar system, at least for me, you know, like a pause in what might or might not be action. And then we get like, you know, this really kind of like an amazing amount of sort of like detail, but in a short and like deliberately underexplained kind of way.
It's a kind of cool way to build the world without putting all this like expository dialogue into the mouth of a character and having like an awkward, you know, scene of like, well, this is how, oh, hello, visitor from another galaxy. Yes. This is how Terminator works. You know,
have you seen today's paper? It has an interesting history.
Yeah. And I think it's, I was leafing through my other KSR novels. It feels like it's the first time he uses this kind of model of very short, like sort of narrative chapters and then short, like weird expository things. And then like different sort of forms. I think that's basically right. Unless I'm missing something from like the Science and the Capital trilogy, which I haven't read, but I think it's the first time he sort of works with this kind of form.
Which you see in a really, I mean, I think takes on, is really interesting in New York 2140. And then of course we talked about it a lot in Ministry for the Future. And it's also interesting here because I think that this book and Aurora are clearly very closely related. And some of this kind of this kind of play of like distancing or formal breaks in Aurora, a lot of that comes through Ship as the narrator, as the sort of like organizing like consciousness of the novel, and Ship's own sort of like meta reflections on telling a story. I find it an interesting kind of comparison, right? I would say that like, you know, in Aurora, like narrative matters much, much more than it matters here, even though there is a narrative here, but it matters a lot more in Aurora. Obviously like the chapters centered around characters, like, you know, that could flash us back to the Mars books, but we're never as like tightly, we're like relatively focalized here, but I think not as tightly focalized as we are in the Mars books.
I think one of the cool things about the character chapters where it's like Swan and Alex, or Swan and Waram, or Waram and Swan, is that it does emphasize rather the narrative, it emphasizes characters and character relations to each other, and also tells you that like when a chapter's named Swan and Aram and Waram, it's different. You're going to get a different experience than when it's named Waram and Swan.
And
so like that emphasizes like how, you know, to really focus on relation and the way the characters sort of build their worlds for themselves, you know, in a sense, or like how the world presents itself to them in a specific way. Which emphasizes too, I think, the chapter on Terminator, which the chapter called Terminator, which it gives a kind of, you know, brief description of the city, ends on this moment where it says, thus Terminator citizens continuously glide and walk over their world, remaking it day by day into something more expressive of their thoughts. All cities and all their citizens move in just such a way. Mm. So there's a sense that like at Terminator, they have figured this out for one reason or another. The inhabitants of Terminator know that they do this as citizens of a city, that they make their world every day, but that the novel tells us, you know, this is, whether you know it or not, whether you're conscious of it or not, the way all cities and all citizens operate, that we are always constantly making our world. And so that, you know, that gives that hint, that glimmer of like, if we, you know, sort of raise the consciousness level of that fact of living, we might end up living in a different way as well. Although there is the sense also that the inhabitants of Terminator are allowed to know that, or like there are affordances that make them aware of that in a way that we mere mortals who don't live in the novel 2312 do not have such affordances all the time.
That's really interesting. I hadn't made that sort of connection before, but in I think the chapter right before that, I'm on page 26. Mm-hmm. I think this is on the way back from the Tintoretto. Waram is looking at the Sunwalkers, and he says, "So they have to keep moving. How do they rest, eat, and sleep? We eat on our feet and sleep in carts pulled by companions," Swan said. "We take turns at that, and on it goes." He gave her a look. "So you have an inexorable spur to action. I can see the appeal." She almost, because the Sunwalkers have to keep walking, otherwise they're going to get burned to death, right? Mm-hmm. So you have an inexorable spur to action. I can see the appeal. She almost laughed. "Do you need such a spur? I think everyone does, don't you?" "No, not at all." "But you join these ferals," he said. "That's just to do it, to see the land and the sun. I check out things I made or do a little crack mining. I don't need to find reasons to stay busy." This was exactly backward, she realized, and shut him out. It's her moments. I mean, what makes her like not an unbearable person is that she has these moments of sort of like self-awareness, and you can like feel, at least I feel with sympathy, her sort of like choking back of like, oh God, I just, you know, like I just told an absolute untruth about myself to a person who probably actually can guess that that is an untruth.
Who knows better? He says, you're lucky. Most people do. And it's like, there is that moment of, you know, I hopefully we've all had it, but I definitely have it, where you talk yourself into a corner and you have to force your, and you're forcing yourself into saying something that you know isn't true. And if you have kind of a sense of, you know, personal fortitude or strength, you can say, what am I talking about? That's totally wrong. Why am I saying that? I don't want to be saying that. That's not right. Let me go back and like work my way out of it. But she's at a point in her life where she the pride is overtaking her that she can't like reverse course.
And also there is some sense that like she is, you know, she is unhappy with both with the things that she has done in the past and with the reasoning that she's developed for why she has done them. And this I think is all toward the end of the next chapter, after she finally finds the communiques left behind from Alex and realizes that, yeah, she's going to have to set out, she's going to have to leave home and she's going to have to set out, you know, with, the toad and the small to find Wong of Io. I think she's talking to Makarat. Is that right? Yes. And Makarat says, be ready to act. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she whose life has been actually about continuous action, running, right? Crazy bodily performance, self-modification, being an artist, being a sunwalker, being a seeker, doing all of these things, right? Suddenly, like the relationship to action is then changing here. Although also this is like funny because the question, like we get over and over again, I think this sort of like question of, is an action happening here, right? Is, you know, like, because we think be ready to act, like she's going to get to like Io and like, you know, some bad shit is going to happen and she is going to have to like be a hero. And like, that's not exactly what ends up happening, you know? So I think there is this real question here about like, what is an action, and particularly what is the kind of action that actually has an effectivity or like makes a difference, and does that ever come from an individual, you know?
Well, the difference between acting and action and the difference between performance. And acting.
Yeah.
Because it's like, yes, she's acting all the time, but she's acting in the sense of a performance. And yeah, when you said that she's becoming, or she's either she's coming to the realization that she's increasingly dissatisfied with the things that she does and the reasons that she has done them. That, you know, that definitely is clarifying in terms of like what her sort of character is, and kind of like sick of the performances that she used to do, kind of like, you know, not a landscape artist anymore. Oh, I don't do the escutcheon design anymore. I actually hate the fact that I did that. Even to the point of like, I hate Pauline. I hate this like voice that I installed inside my head that talks to me all the time. And so now my only relationship to Pauline is to like tell her to shut up, even though it's fully in my power to turn her off. But you know, there's just these, so again, going back to the beginning of our conversation today, just like these forms of attachment that she has that are the normal for her. And if she were to actually act, to do a genuine action, not just a performative action, that would mean like severing some of those attachments and plunging into a new kind of a new mode of habituation, a new like sense of the iterative, a new self, you know, having really start to develop a new self for herself. I know you wanted to, you mentioned, we should probably stop now because we've been going for about an hour and a half and I have some dinner preparations to start making. But in the Swan and Alex chapter, you mentioned the purloined letter.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I want to know if you had some more specific thoughts about that, because I think I had, noticed it the first time around, but I hadn't really thought that much about it. But on this one page, my page 31, the purloined letter is there. there's a oval mirror, which is like, there's an oval portrait essentially, like there's a Edgar Allan Poe potentially referenced there. The jewelry box comes to life, opens up because every, you know, I guess it's, I guess Alex had like a smart house, internet of things, right? Everything is, everything is animated. Everything is alive in the future. And so I wonder if you had any, thoughts on that, on the Purloin letter.
Well, I don't have anything super developed. I mean, I think that the, and I think that there are more, references to, and to sort of like jokes about, detective stories and detection, in this book than I will, you know, I cannot pretend to have sort of like excavated all of them. And, you know, Jean Genette, the inspector, is both clearly, you know, a stock character, an inspector, you know, yeah, I mean, so there's a lot, there's like a lot of play here with like the genericness or something. I think that in that scene, and I was trying to think about the way in which, like, you know, in the purloined letter, in that story by Poe, right? Like, although we learn what the contents of the letter are, the contents just don't matter, right? What matters is that the detective, what is his name? What's Poe's detective?
No, Maupassant is another act, is another author.
God damn it.
Dupin.
D-U-P-I-N. Right. Monsieur Dupin. So, you know, the act of detection is figuring out where the secret is located. The secret is simply the location of the secret, right? And the information inside the letter, which is that, you know, somebody is having an affair with somebody or whatever it is, like really doesn't matter, is about a kind of like, is something that is essentially secondary to what is revealed or what needs to be detected. And so here Swan herself thinks, okay, where, if Alex left something for me, where would it be? Well, it might be a purloined letter type thing because she didn't like to use computers, right? Or cubes, quantum computers. And so she probably would have just like left it out on her desk on a piece of paper. And that's the thought that she has, right? Which is where the purloined letter is in the story, right? It's just out on the desk. It's hidden in plain sight. So you can see why, like, obviously psychoanalysts like the story. But then, you know, to follow that sort of thought, like then Swan wanders around the room and she goes into the bathroom and she's like looking at herself in one mirror and then looking at herself in the other mirror. She's looking at herself and says, I'm here, Alex. Which is what triggers the room AI to open up, as you were saying, the little jewelry box, in which there are letters, but then they're not actually written on paper. They are actually like little like discs or whatever that Swan needs to give to other people, and one that she gets to plug into Pauline. So she does not get to see the contents of them at all. But like, it does not seem incidental that rather, so in some ways, like the thing that she finds is not actually like a purloined letter. It's like her own image, right? It's her image in the mirror. And it's her image in the mirror when she says, I'm here, looking at herself, she says, I'm here, Alex. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're kind of like in some ways then, and then she plugs like the info into Pauline, into her cube, right? So in some ways, like Swan herself is like, you know, is the purloined letter, right? Mm-hmm. She is like the kind of like, and the secret is not like something hidden inside her, right? Which is why I think all of this stuff about action and like, you know, it's not like she's not somebody who doesn't think about things. She's not unreflective, right? In fact, she seems to like think in certain ways all the time, right?
Neurotic, if anything, yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, I think there's probably like way more that play with this that you could really do. But maybe at the very least, what it sets us up for is like, whatever it is that we're finding here and whatever it is that's going to propel the action of the story, is not going to be like that hidden content, right? And in fact, we can probably put together for ourselves by some point what that hidden content is. And that really is secondary to something else, right? To the detection itself, to the ability to think about like where would the vital thing have been placed rather than like what's hidden inside it. And I think that that has something to do with like, you know, reconceiving like, I mean, it has something to do with reconceiving like what a narrative is for, right? A narrative is not for like the revelation of secrets, right? It's not, you know, gossip about imaginary people.
I would say, I would just add, you know, she says, I'm here, Alex, I'm here if you want me. So there's something to do with desire there as well, yeah, potentially. And what is it that we actually desire when we're reading a narrative, or what does specifically the character of Swan desire that is driving her, you know, actions?
But it
is a question when you put it in these terms, that what is the point of narrative? Is it just to unveil narrative secrets? There's going around on Twitter, which I really have to quit, is this anger about quote unquote unnecessary sex scenes in movies, which is like, okay, if you're upset about things that supposedly distract from the plot, then just read the summary of the movie on IMDb. Like, you know, if you only want to know how the narrative ends, that can be done in a sentence. The whole point of the point of a novel, the point of a story is not to find out what happens at the end. It's to have the experience, have a multitude of, you know, aesthetic experiences that, you know, take you, that rip you apart,
right?
That take you into different directions, not the one that, you know, the authoritarian one that you believe that daddy author wants you to have or something like that, you know?
Oh, right, exactly. And also like that the, you know, what the narrative is not something, I mean, you know, there's like a story or a summary that can maybe get separated out, but the narrative is like not separable from like the things that happen along the way, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway.
Very, very frustrating. Yeah, very, very frustrating.
Shouldn't argue with stupid people.
No, you should not. So if we wanted to think more about the whole pearl and letter thing, we should read that Lacan essay on the purloined letter, but I don't know when we'll have time to do that.
Bonus episode.
We're going to talk about Lacan.
Next time a genius literary critic passes away, we'll just do a bonus episode on them rather than try to fold it into our normal broadcasting.
So we have episodes that are about novels, and then we have episodes that are about movies, and then we have episodes about when somebody dies.
And they're all the same. All episodes.
They're all the same, right?
Death.
Yeah.
Essentially, all about death. What we're talking about.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're gonna leave it at the end of the Swan and Alex, the second Swan and Alex chapter, when she, you know, and it's funny. We should just mention Warham and Jeanette both ask her, "Did she leave anything for you? Is there a note that she asked you to pass on to us?" And she's like, "No." And then finally there is. And so they, again, it's like disrupts the whole detective novel, because it's like there's these two guys who know more about the whole scenario than she does, even though she's supposed to be in on it. And so it's like this narrative irony is all
right,
over
right,
the place.
Right.
But
yeah,
so
exactly.
Finally she's like revealed, like, no, I have these messages for these people, and now I am gonna go to Io, to Jupiter or Saturn, Jupiter. And then that's what's going to happen next.
Yes, that's what's going to happen next. I'm making on my notes, I'm crossing out the things that we did talk about today and leaving the things that we did not talk about today.
Great. Okay. So thanks for your patience. We got through half of what we intended to get through, but that's going to be the nature of the podcast.
Yes. And will continue to be the nature of the podcast.
You can email us at maroononmarspodcast@gmail.com or tweet us at podcastonmars on Twitter. And thank you for listening.
Yes, thank you very much for listening. Thanks for putting up with us as always.
Okay, goodbye.
Bye.